For those who would love to see the entire Bushreich thrown behind bars for treason, and I am certainly among them, the Downing Street minutes of July 2002 and the illegal pre-invasion air war that followed are a recent cause célèbre. To make their case about the air war, various Bush critics, Scott Ritter most vehemently, have pointed to an airstrike on September 5, 2002, in which around 100 coalition planes bombarded an airbase in central Iraq. This marked an abrupt escalation of the coalition's routine bombing sprees, better known as the Watch operations, that is, Operation Southern Watch and Operation Northern Watch. By attacking a target well outside either no-fly zone, the September 5, 02 strike also violated the normal airspace restrictions on these operations. Prior to this date, so the story goes, the Watch operations were everything they were claimed to be, a valiant umbrella thrown up to protect Iraq's beleaguered minorities, that is, the Kurds and Shia. After September 5, that mission became a thin pretext for wrecking Saddam's air defenses and clearing the way for invasion. I don't dispute that the escalation happened, or that the Watch operation's alleged mission was used as a false pretext by Bush. Those charges are completely plausible. What bothers me is the conceit that the humanitarian shield pitch was ever more than a flimsy PR cover story for a low-intensity siege on Saddam's political survival. Always a favorite excuse for U.S. wars, humanitarianism has never actually featured in any of them. Indeed, humanitarian war must be about the most grotesque oxymoron ever to make the rounds. The term no-fly zone sums up the Watch operation's primary business, which was to control air traffic, especially military traffic, within these zones. But this was not all they did. They also attacked ground targets in a manner completely inconsistent with the Watch operation's official language, more like what one would see during unrestricted warfare. This was going on before the Bush II administration assumed power. UN humanitarian coordinator Hans von Sponeck found this sort of thing extremely interesting and investigated many of these incidents personally. In 1999, he produced a report, Airstrikes in Iraq, which immediately provoked controversy and U.S. denials. The substance of the report was the 70-some suspicious strikes recorded by von Sponeck between January 7 and March 16, 1999. For those who need reminding, this would be under Clinton's watch. Bush's equivalent tally for the four-month period beginning September 5, 02 was around 90 such strikes. To make a long story short, Clinton's escalation of 1999 looks no more like a humanitarian shield than Bush's so-called illegal air war. There are qualitative differences, and Bush's onslaught lasted nearly twice as long, but both episodes were of a single character. Strikes on most categories and strikes overall were actually more frequent under Clinton. Clinton's rampage also began with a big opening assault. Only in Clinton's case, this attack, Operation Desert Fox, was truly gigantic, far larger than Bush's strike of September 5, 02. Both campaigns involved deliberate efforts to destroy Iraq's civil air defense system, anti-aircraft batteries, surface-to-air missile sites, air bases, and civil defense radars were all attacked repeatedly, which is puzzling if one assumes the Watch operations were strictly protective in nature. Were the Kurds and Shia all buzzing around in airplanes? The destruction of radars is especially inconsistent. Under the Watch operations official rubric, what could possibly justify this? It could be argued, I suppose, that the crippling of air defense capability allowed the Watch operations to do their work, but this too involves faulty assumptions. In keeping with the clear sovereign right of nations to drive foreign marauders from their territory, Iraq's use of its air defense system against the Watch operations was inherently defensive, not aggressive. By the same token, the coalition's so-called counterattacks on those sites were aggressive and not defensive. Aggressive and defensive are the exact words this government always twists inside out in precisely this way every time it embarks on an imperial adventure. This particular word game should prompt close examination every time. The only plausible explanation left from all this is that the Watch operation's so-called humanitarian mission was used, sporadically at least, to conceal the systematic destruction of Iraq's civil air defense capability. If this was wicked under Bush, it was no less wicked under Clinton. Even more incriminating were the surgical bombings of oil industry sites during both periods. How could this activity possibly fall under protecting Kurds? Upon inauguration, Clinton committed to maintaining Bush I's Iraq policy. He was as good as his word. Authorization continued for troop escalations, illegal bombardments, this includes the watch operations, sanctions, and the CIA's standard ruthless conspiracies to topple Saddam. In December of 98, just before the period under examination here, Clinton authorized Operation Desert Fox, the most intensive bombing blitz of the 12 years between full-scale wars. Desert Fox consisted of 4 days of bomber and cruise missile strikes that pounded central Iraq for the first time in 7 years. The targets had been identified by fake weapons inspectors, actually U.S. spies, infiltrated into UNSCOM. Discovering these spies in the summer of 98, Saddam expelled all weapons inspectors but then reversed this decision in November. Shortly before Desert Fox, the inspectors were again withdrawn, this time on Clinton's order. Clinton then lied to the American public, blaming this second expulsion on Saddam and using this so-called violation as a pretext for a massive unilateral bombing campaign. As a breach of public trust, this intrigue was far more serious than the concurrent Lewinsky thing, and yet Clinton's venomous political opponents remained oddly silent. Clearly, this attack wasn't about protecting anyone in Iraq, nor was it about punishing Saddam. Its real motivations remained secret and were probably political and strategic. Its illegality, on the other hand, is an open book. In December of 2000, Clinton discredited Northern Watch's humanitarian pretext for good by suspending coalition air patrols of the Northern No-Fly Zone, thus allowing a Turkish force to invade Iraqi Kurdistan and attack the PKK, an anti-Turkish revolutionary front. No foreign journalists or troops accompanied this invasion force, and to this day no one knows how many they killed. They're known to have wiped out entire Kurdish towns. Then there's the most monstrous crime of all, the decade of agony brought down on all of Iraqi society by the twin hammers of bombed-out public health infrastructures and the most draconian sanctions program in modern history. The sanctions were Clinton's baby. Though ostensibly a UN program, their scope and nature were undoubtedly leveraged by the US and Britain, two countries that have always enjoyed decisive control over the international body. Put the sanctions, the covert programs, and the illegal bombing campaigns together, and you have a pretty classic CIA-style program of destabilization, as seen in Eastern Europe, Cuba, Nicaragua, and elsewhere. Destabilization is just a coy word for U.S. state terror waged against entire national populations as a means to weaken and topple their governments. One thing critics have missed about the watch operations is that they provided air superiority for minority rebel factions, especially Kurdish, who were attacking all bastions of Sunni Ba'athist control. By the U.S. government's standard for itself and its allies, these were so-called terrorist groups, whom Saddam had every right to suppress but could not because of the watch operations. In this way, the watches supported rebel control of the no-fly zones and were really a cornerstone of the U.S. destabilization strategy. Simultaneously, the CIA was funding, equipping, training, and agitating these groups, and in this way pushing them to do their worst. There are clear parallels to the CIA's 1981 through 89 terror war against Nicaragua, and Clinton bears direct responsibility for all of it. To understand what all this is really about, it's necessary to review the full history of U.S. antagonism toward Saddam. Save for a few bumpy spots, like the Arab oil embargo, he was a State Department puppet in good standing right into the 1980s. After all, he and his Ba'athist brethren were installed 20 years earlier by the CIA when it toppled Mohammad Mossadegh's Nasser-aligned government. The CIA needed a new regime it could rely on to chunk every last communist in Iraq into an unmarked grave, and the Ba'athists filled the bill nicely. Typical of such puppets, Saddam's now infamous brutality attracted nary a word of comment from U.S. pundits and demagogues. All this changed in the mid-80s when Saddam thwarted a U.S. bid to gain control of Iraq via coercive so-called international development policy. Though fully committed to Iraq's modernization, Saddam had little use for the bait on this hook, since Iraq's state oil monopoly generated all the public sector funds he could possibly need. Iraq's mineral wealth was being used to benefit Iraq, a grievous crime against ExxonMobil. Also, Saddam had emerged as Middle East's most aggressive and determined pan-Arab nationalist leader, the deadliest sin of all. All this precipitated the next natural stage of the imperial game: defamation, economic warfare, destabilization. He would now become an official boogeyman, deserving of any punishment, including military action. First, a pretext for engagement was generated by drawing him into Kuwait and then shoving him back out. During 10 years of intensive destabilization, we tried to erode his authority, but also chewed down his defenses in case this didn't work. Sure enough, it didn't. So the U.S. moved to the next phase of this very simple progression: invasion. By 2003, the assumption must have been that Iraq had been bled chalk white and would welcome any sort of conclusion with sobbing relief. This script is not new. The U.S. has been playing this decades-long game all around the world for the past 60 years. The parallels to the Vietnam progression, for example, are uncanny. If they continue, we may yet see this episode advance to the most unsavory stage of all, rapprochement. I am not playing a partisan game here. In fact, that is precisely what I'm countering. The point is not that Billy Clinton was a bad, bad boy, but that he was a full partner in this progression, laying down as much groundwork as anyone for the present level of U.S. involvement. The entire 14-year span of U.S. adventurism in Iraq, from Operation Desert Storm to the present, is one coherent, graduated campaign. What this in turn reveals is that all the hoopla about philosophical differences between America's dominant parties, all pretense that these presidents aren't merely technicians following orders from above, lest they end up like Kennedy, or that Americans have any measure of electoral control over U.S. foreign policy, is a mere good cop, bad cop PR game. If Bush is more brazen than Clinton with the same wicked agenda, that's because the bad cop doesn't have to pretend to be nice. Every other multi-decade U.S. foreign adventure reveals the same ominous absence of partisanship in U.S. foreign policy, while the scathing criticisms of these always involve this delusional partisan bickering. Bitter exposés of the rabid right by the back-broken left, a la Christopher Hitchens' The Trial of Henry Kissinger. McCarthyist attacks on liberal traitors by the likes of Rush Limbaugh, whose creative work is a daily crust of the American media diet. It is unusual to witness a political criticism coming from anywhere outside this contrived catfight. It is especially uncommon to find a critic stepping out of this box far enough to reveal both sides as one thing. An illusion of healthy public debate emerges, enough so to assuage any suspicion to the contrary, while in truth the so-called left and right mainstreams agree on 50% to 100% of the issues, depending on which two are talking to each other. All of which sets up and reinforces a weird, devout faith in the good cops, the leaders of the putative left, who are revered by many millions of Americans who also suppose they are of the left, and who imagine that if we just get rid of Georgie the Big Bad Wolf, everything will be fine again, just like back in the good old Clinton days. These people's minds are trapped in a United States that died forever 60 years ago with the emergence of the post-World War II national security state, a.k.a. Nazi America. They simply don't have the heart to let this sink in. Instead, they retreat into a readily available system of conceits regarding the nature of American power, the better to be oblivious to its deepest evident meanings. I've seen all I can stand of this tendency on the self-styled left, and I write this to fire two barrels of reality buckshot straight into the brains of people who should know better. The United States is not a democracy. It is the most organized and nuanced class dictatorship in history, and well on its way to becoming the ugliest, a thing the Nazis would have recognized and admired instantly, since, minus the Aryan nonsense, it's an idealization of their own vision for Germany. Indeed, U.S. practices of the preceding 80-plus years served as primary models for the Nazis' five most infamous programs. 1. The science of mass manipulation, in which Goebbels and company, built on the groundwork of Woodrow Wilson's U.S. Committee on Public Information, headed by Walter Lippmann and Edward Bernays, Sigmund Freud's nephew, by the way. This World War I propaganda organ originated what we now call public relations. 2. A creepy state security apparatus. U.S. antecedents include the Pinkerton Detective Agency and J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, the U.S. state's first formal secret police, another Wilson creation. 3. The Hitler Youth. The fascist program of socializing boys to the military life was first conceived by Sir Baden-Powell of Great Britain and directly copied here in the 1920s under the same name, the Boy Scouts. 4. Concentration camps. The Nazis formally studied and adapted the civilian detainment concept innovated by the U.S. Army during its conquest of the Philippines circa 1900. The Philippine reconcentrados, as they were called, were modeled in turn after early Indian reservations, especially the horrific variation seen in California. 5. Genocide. The most infamous of all Nazi war crimes, but again, the U.S. beat them to it with equally diabolical Indian policies, for example, scalp bounties. Our related anti-communist policy of exterminatory full-scale war wouldn't reach full growth until after World War II, but still harks back to the failed 1918 Allied invasion of Russia following the Bolshevik Revolution. Granted, this government isn't starving, gassing, and incinerating millions of undesirables just yet. Instead, it's concentrating them into the largest prison system the world has ever seen, larger even than that of Stalinist Russia. Do not doubt that this is a kind of death. Blacks particularly are the targets of an incarceration effort that has very creepy eugenic overtones. Suppressing a people's reproductive capacity doesn't require killing them. Just shove the young virile men into cages until they're middle-aged. The same policy serves to demolish black family life, communities, and ultimately any prospect of a black cultural resurgence, i.e. a strong sense of identity. This is the same coup de grace once dealt to Native American cultures by state-sponsored Indian boarding schools. Boldly but briefly, this agenda, as it relates to black culture, thrust its head out in plain sight when local and federal law enforcement killed the NOW movement in Philadelphia. There are other less dramatic examples. Nonviolent drug crimes are the main excuse for doing all this to blacks, but if drugs are the real issue, why does the U.S. government have a clear, proven, decades-long hand in importation and distribution? Wouldn't closing that supply valve make more sense than keeping this bait laying around and wrecking the life of anyone who picks it up? If not for the way World War II demolished Germany's industrial capacity and transport infrastructures, meaning its ability to sustain large populations, the Germans may well have taken their ethnic elimination programs no further than we've now taken ours. The main war front for this sort of thing is not here at home, however, where almost no one really understands the word struggle. It's out there, in the global realm of America's vast colonial holdings. In Africa, for example, where ghastly, often genocidal wars have been serving U.S. strategic economic interests for several decades, Angola, Rwanda, Burundi, Congo, Sierra Leone, Sudan. In these we see the same calculated passive aggression. The United States has played a constant role in weaponizing these countries and whipping political and factional tensions toward full-blown war. Then when the hatred boils over, this government very studiously looks the other way while maintaining the flow of logistical necessities. Why step in? That would assume black Africans exterminating each other is a bad thing. Like most of the rest of the world, Africa is a domain of hegemonic Western control and has been for 100-plus years. Such things don't happen without our passive participation. This is true in terms of weapons alone. The standard line that these are, quote, independent countries that do what they want, close quote, would be hilarious if it weren't so ruthlessly false. Every time one of these countries has attempted to become exactly that, assorted Western spooks have slipped out of the shadows and slit the throats of the people responsible. Similar themes are visible in the U.S. government's apathy regarding Africa's AIDS pandemic, also in U.S.-Haiti relations going back 110 years, also in policies aimed at willful indigenous societies in Latin America. The rural Maya of Guatemala's northwestern highlands, for example, where Ronald Reagan's pet puppet, Rios Montt, subjected the natives to horrors sickening beyond words. The quiet finesse and far-off invisibility of these patterns doesn't make America's fascism less real, only more insidious and effective. So masterful are its perceptual engineering methods that Americans have become the proverbial frogs in boiling water. Even the dissidents can't see it. This is why the Nazis would be so spellbound. Of course, the perceptual engineering gets a big assist from certain innate prejudices. Americans are A, willfully deluded as to this nation's history, clearly preferring happy myths to gritty truths, and B, the thing they want to know least is that their aggregate moral culture has always been quite like that of a fascist state. What we did to Indians, for example, was far more damning than what Germans did to Jews. The Holocaust's most obscene work was tucked out of sight in closed facilities, cleverly sanitized and conducted by a select few on an industrial scale within a few years, while the U.S. indigenous bloodbath was perpetrated openly, crudely, and with unmistakable enthusiasm by the general American public for over 100 years. The 1864 massacre of Cheyenne at Sand Creek, Colorado, is one example of hundreds. When other European cultures preceded Americans in the same territory, as in French Louisiana or Spanish Ozatlan, their worst treatment of natives paled in comparison to later American practice. These earlier usurpers were not so hell-bent on opening the West, i.e., erasing every obstacle to possessing it absolutely, even when this meant obliterating other human societies, half of which were completely unoffending. This larger crime, perpetrated by ourselves, is the one Americans really should never forget, but we've forgotten already. It's not one of the happy myths. The U.S. genocide of Native Americans also exceeded the Holocaust in that it actually realized genocide's essential goal, the effective total erasure of its victims' cultures. A pattern transacted not once, but hundreds of times for each of a multitude of unique societies across an area 1.5 times the size of Western Europe. So what if mere examples of the race are still to be found? It was their cultures, meaning their ability to live outside the class dictatorship, that were the real threat. Colonial settlements were blatant microcosms of European-style class bigotry and exploitation. Indian culture, on the other hand, and on a level comprehensible by anyone, displayed the realities of free-living, egalitarian social principle, not the sham substitutes we've accepted. Simply by existing alongside the settlements, intact native societies compared their abusive social order to a radically different possibility, and by this contrast made its full meaning obvious to all, most importantly, to the serfs and slaves working themselves to death at the bottom. This was tantamount to hurling strong acid on colonial class society. To prospective colonial barons, the lessons were clear. Amicable relations between Indians and the colonial labor class could not be permitted. Before settlement could expand into new areas, then, resident Indians would have to be eradicated with pandemics or driven off and made hostile with what amounted to paramilitary operations. Meanwhile, the peculiar American hypertrophy of the grow exponentially or die capitalist imperative was emerging already, compelling the death squads to keep pushing ever outward, well in advance of acknowledged frontiers. In keeping with the age-old partnership between clergy and class elites, latent supremacism was whipped to theological heights in the weekly brainwashing sessions every colonist was expected to attend. As the colonies won independence, united, and expanded into every livable area of the continent, this psychopathology only hardened and gained momentum, becoming a cultural imprint visible to this day. It even received a suitably arrogant name, Manifest Destiny. By 1900, then, we were already the political and cultural model for everything the Germans would become. Then we dug our collective moral grave yet deeper by launching new campaigns to destroy yet more cultures. The emerging political culture of communism, for example. Another strong acid thrown on the class order, the strongest and most sophisticated yet. The demolition of the communist cultural experiment is now almost complete, its last enclaves under a steady siege. Combine the U.S. role in this with those of its client states and defective strategic partners, which includes Nazi Germany, and the dimensions of this genocide eclipse all previous ones, planet-wide in scale, decades in duration, killing many tens of millions, immiserating billions by locking down a global totalitarian colonial order and in the process demolishing a score or so of real democracies. Don't scoff, most of them were at least as democratic as the current American parody. Now we're starting in on our largest genocidal target yet, Islam. It too has become an impediment to the total power psychosis of U.S. empire. As we drive this religious culture into the killing box of our third great genocide, some of them have tried appealing to reason, explaining why they prefer their culture to ours, and that their right to do so is inalienable. We've used this only to seal our case, holding it up to illustrate how different, meaning inferior, they are, and how extreme is their hatred for us. Given our history, there is a gruesome inevitability to this. In fact, they do have that right. Is this not the essential meaning of self-determination? Especially when their reasons for rejecting our ways are quite sound, our excesses of narcissism, materialism, greed, decadence, cowardice, rampant class bigotry, and contempt for other cultures are at least as loathsome as their own foibles. The real purpose of the propaganda and provocations coming from our side, and again, this is totally calculated, is to push Islam into taking on precisely the character we've already assigned to it. It bears repeating that we don't have to kill all of them or even most of them for our efforts to satisfy genocide's essential meaning, which relates to the destruction of cultures, not populations. For 90 years, the West has unilaterally waged a masterful political, cultural, economic war against the Middle East, while bearing the sword only on strategic occasion, Iraq being exemplary. If this government has been remarkably lenient, that's because Americans have done exactly as desired with very little prodding. Our special proclivities, that is, to see our society and government through a fog of tame delusions while serving as a vast reservoir of latent avid bloodlust, always leaping to our master's cause, a favor never returned, these are probably the greatest root causes of U.S. primacy today. To launch their expansionist rampages, U.S. imperialists have only needed to awaken and unleash this latent monster, and have done so throughout their tenure. This explains, in turn, why our conquests have always involved spectacular ferocity, well represented by the term total war. Another of our coy phrases, this one simply means we'll abandon any amount of principle in order to win, even to the point of becoming demonic. Though the U.S. government is the obvious custodian of our war-mongrel alter ego, it's really just an intermediary for the services it provides. The party actually consuming those services is an oligarchy, an aristocracy, concentrated in the U.S., but whose power now envelops the entire planet. This superclass is the real global empire, a straightforward monarchy consolidated decades ago as an integral result of colonialism and the world wars, and opposite which the Soviet Union was the last rival worth mentioning. The reign of monarchs and their aristocratic henchmen has not vaguely ended, is still the deepest truth of the political order. It is their influence that explains the fuzzy image called shadow government. The ultra-privileged, it seems, will always leverage all the influence they need. Once a truly radical idea, democracy, or in spy parlance, the grand illusion, has degenerated into merely their ultimate Orwellian triumph. It keeps the hoi polloi nicely distracted arranging deck chairs, tricked by this petty control into believing their hands are on the wheel of the great ship itself. The left has become fixated on corporations as the ultimate culprit behind all this, but this is a misperception. Corporations are only enormously forceful tools, instruments through which wealth and power can be pooled and their effects multiplied. The party, with its hand on this lever, is a rampantly abusive aristocratic class, the same culprit as always. Only their methods change. Every politician in the world shrewd enough to secure an elite position figures these things out, and most accept the pragmatic necessity of their subordination to this global monarchical order. Pragmatism, after all, is merely corruption's favorite nickname, and politicians tend to be either intensely corruptible or retired. Those who reject this assigned role and embark on their own course must have a spine of steel to do so. Their fate, being marginalized, ruined, and/or assassinated as a stern warning to others, has become an unmistakable historical reality. But they accept it and go forward regardless. That's the steel spine part. Examples include Lenin, Mao, Kim Jong-il, Castro, Ho Chi Minh, Saddam Hussein, Muammar Gaddafi, Hugo Chavez, Omar Torrijos, Jaime Roldos, Patrice Lumumba, Sukarno, Allende, Qasem, Arbenz, Mossadegh, Aristide, many, many more. Every one of them rode a tidal wave of popular anti-imperial sentiment, and 60% wound up ruined or dead. Always, this political type is vilified mercilessly, portrayed as insane Satans by the aristocracy's global propaganda machine. Not all are heroes, nor are their experiments always defensible, but their transgressions are totally irrelevant to the publicity they receive from extremely corrupt Western media. Those portrayals are actually strategic attacks on their political survival, punishments exacted for their defiance of crime families with global reach, analogous in every way to mafia dynasties, but never subject to scrutiny as such by their own propaganda industries. With great consistency, those industries pounce upon every transgression of strong anti-colonial leaders while giving our sons of bitches, FDR's expression, a free path, even when their abuses are unbearable to contemplate. Indeed, the Western aristocracy's dedicated colonial subordinates make up the vanguard of the world's most heinous dictators, master technicians of tin-pot fascist states that make Hitler's Germany seem idyllic. Hitler, at least, was forcibly stopped, while these tyrants reign for decades, opposed only by feeble underground resistance movements. Invariably, U.S. administrations strangle international efforts to support those movements, since the tin pot tyrants are actually U.S. colonial lackeys merely following the State Department's detailed instructions. Again, examples are legion. Ngo Dinh Diem, General Rafael Trujillo, General Mobutu Sese Seko, General Mohamed Suharto, General Augusto Pinochet, Baby Doc Duvalier, Anastasio Somoza Jr., and Ferdinand Marcos exemplify a curious subtype. Western Empire suck-ups whose assigned duties attracted worldwide notice and condemnation, thus endangering the whole game by, again, revealing its true function and meaning. The first two were assassinated with presidential approval and CIA assistance, while the others were unceremoniously dumped, leaving them in dumb shock. The true men of steel, however, the unbending ones, Omar Torrijos, Che Guevara, etc., fully understood their days were numbered. All this demolishes America's historical rhetoric in two ruinous ways. One, America has not quietly recolonized the world in order to, quote, rescue its people from tyranny, close quote, but to crush their dreams of ever experiencing anything else. Two, this wasn't why we went after Hitler and Tojo, either. The U.S. Empire's stake in World War II was the same as for every other external conflict going back to the 1840s, the expansion and consolidation of its own interests. We don't really have a problem with fascism, per se. Even back when fascism was the boogeyman of the day, and you couldn't get them to shut up about it, our public figures quietly supported Franco and Salazar for decades. It was aggressive expansionism that put the Nazis on our death list. That's our gig. This context reduces the Nazis' real historical role from ultimate bad guys to mere rivals. Even as we accused Hitler of pursuing global domination, this was precisely our own motive. It wasn't until after World War II, however, that our propaganda industry struck the Orwellian motherlode known as the Holocaust, which would forever render Americans incapable of critiquing their own role in world affairs. While the European War was going on, Washington insiders knew all about Germany's anti-Jewish policies, knew about them and didn't particularly care. It's widely known, for example, that a shipload of Jewish refugees was effectively handed back to the Nazis by U.S. immigration authorities. Then after the war, this freaky thing happened. Those same German policies suddenly became the biggest news football of all, so much so that a new and preposterous narrative of World War II was nurtured into existence, in which stopping Hitler from doing all that was why we went to war in the first place. The idea is rarely stated this boldly by the people pushing it. It's like Edward Bernays used to say, never state a clearly demonstrable lie. Instead, the standard narrative keeps us on a steady diet of all the pieces needed to form this common-sense conclusion on our own. This has been a spectacular success, generating the following universal received wisdom about World War II. A. The Holocaust was history's gravest crime, so therefore B. The Nazis were history's ultimate villains, ergo C. Americans are history's ultimate heroes, since we vanquished the ultimate villains, all of which D. places U.S. foreign policy beyond the possibility of reproach forever. After all, only a boor, a traitor, would insist on criticizing the saviors of all humankind. This is the overarching big lie of post-World War II America, rigorously maintained to this day and kept safe from re-examination by what amounts to rule of law. As long as our grasp of present history remains bottled up inside this mother of all big lies, U.S. ruling families and their public agents can keep hiding behind their fake ultimate hero status forever, and so far so good. It is for this reason that more recent and equally horrible episodes, Vietnam, for example, are constantly bulldozed under with remembrances of World War II and the Holocaust. Otherwise, it might dawn on us that there's a new ultimate villain in town. The myth's most important function is not deranging how we think about the subsequent sweep of U.S. history, since most simply don't, but clouding our present-day perception of U.S. imperial crimes, which look distinctly Nazi-like once this lens is thrown off. All this is a definitive example of the value of public relations, about which more will be said later. By enforced habit, we associate such methods with the Nazis and Soviets, but they were bumbling big-lie buffoons compared to our own political media elites. Hypocrisies such as this ultimate villain, ultimate hero nonsense are an old theme of U.S. public manipulation, and this public keeps falling for them partly out of blind trust, but also because they too are hypocrites living in perfect denial of their real motive, seeking the civic wealth and personal luxuries made possible only by living on the milk and honey end of history's most extreme colonial order. After all, the character of every institution is an aggregate of those who make it up, and this government is a superb example, an extreme expression of U.S. culture, the latter simply being another of these aggregate personalities. The criminal underbelly of U.S. culture is borne out most vividly by the Indian genocides, but also by another episode in U.S. history, one that is desperately ignored, the era of filibusters. Today, the term brings to mind a loophole in U.S. legislative protocol, but during the 19th century, it meant privately sponsored colonizing adventures, generally opposed by the U.S. government for a fascinating reason. Most of the choice targets were already claimed by the European empires, for whom any such incursion would be immediate grounds for war. The superpowers of their day, they'd have repelled these amateurs easily, then maybe followed them home to return the favor. U.S. multimillionaires, equivalent to billionaires today, were on their own then when it came to imperial intrigues, and sure enough, they couldn't restrain themselves. These started after 1810 and continued for 100 years. Texas, stolen from Mexico in 1836 and even bigger then, stretching all the way up to Wyoming's southern border, was this movement's largest prize. Having just gained independence from the Spanish Empire, Mexico was quite weak and thus fair game. As much as this government opposed and discouraged filibusters against other empires, they remained hugely popular with the U.S. public. The most famous mercenary commander was William Walker, an agent of multiple U.S. millionaires, probably led by Cornelius Vanderbilt, the U.S. monarch of his day. Walker's patently criminal exploits were the stuff of hero worship. In June of 1857, while visiting New York between campaigns to conquer the Central American Confederation, Walker was invited to appear at the Bowery Theater, where he was the centerpiece of a gala of jingoism and adoration. He liked this so much he began appearing at other New York theaters, where he was also well received by the country's leading bourgeois society. 7 months later, Mobile, Alabama honored his arrival with a cannon salute. Oliver North was hardly the first of these perverse American celebrities, and neither was Walker. Even earlier, paramilitary Indian fighters like Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett were idolized the same way. The U.S. government did nothing to stop Walker because, again, Central America had previously separated from Spain. New plans for filibusters were publicized with posters and newspaper ads which attracted thousands of volunteers and met with practically no criticism. Some of these were aimed at colonies of foreign empires, for example, Cuba and Canada, and so had to be reined in. Even during this period, when the U.S. government actively opposed such adventures then, its public was eager to pursue them on their own. Like Iraq, these were unprovoked, illegal wars transacted by a deeply kleptopathic society. The volunteers' idea of a fun romp was to enter a neighboring country, steal territory, and kill anyone who tried to stop them, just as they were doing to Indians throughout the same period. Filibusters continued right into the 1900s, even as the U.S. government became more and more willing to sponsor foreign wars. The successful 1911 filibuster of Honduras by banana magnate Sam Zamuri is a good example, and strikingly similar to the 1893 conquest of Hawaii by another fruit baron, Sanford Dole. Both of these would have failed without substantial assistance from the Marines, and the official excuse for these operations, quote, protecting American lives and property, is a classic of imperial disingenuity. Only after this country became fully aligned with the most powerful empire of the day, that being Britain, and thus willing to take on any foe, as during World War I, did the ruling class let the filibuster movement die an unacknowledged death. Finally, the line between the filibusters and formal U.S. colonial adventurism beginning in the 1890s is fuzzy indeed. The robber barons had a clear hand in brokering the Spanish-American War, the first great contest of this period. William Randolph Hearst is only the best known of these figures. Vigorous criticisms of such intrigues by movements such as the Transcendentalists, Henry Thoreau and friends, have been the source of much pretense regarding the moral excellence of the American people. Such movements have always been on the fringe, however. Most Americans have never seen an expansion campaign they didn't like. These often meant whole national populations, for example, the Filipinos, were ground into a red pulp, but this has not mattered to them. On the whole, Americans are deeply naive about empire and resentful of any effort to enlighten them. They only know and only want to know that they like it. On the whole, ambivalence to outright war is their most critical extreme. Interestingly, U.S. anti-imperial movements often appealed most to recent immigrants previously educated in empire's true meaning, who saw exceptionalism for what it is, the native psychology of virulent nationalist bigots. Recent Irish immigrants fresh from the potato famine, for example. That tragedy was caused by British conquest as much as by potato blight, and its refugees saw in the Mexican War, Henry Polk's conquest of northern Mexico, another example of the same disgusting transgressions. Some even crossed over to fight on the Mexican side. This has remained obscure, even though it was more heroic than the antics of the transcendentalists, who mostly mouthed noises in cozy parlors. Those noises have yet to register with the bulk of U.S. society, and as long as our faces remain firmly mashed into the cream-filled boob of global empire, they almost certainly never will. Every conceit this society entertains about how different the U.S. is, how it's an exception from all of the above, or that America is only now suddenly changing for the worse, are an infant's burbling fairy tales. This stuff is American as apple pie. Again, I see the American left laboring under a great and debilitating reluctance to comprehend the enormity of these things, the huge indictment they level at the entire American phenomenon. Instead, apologias are hatched, and these subjects are skirted as a condition of playing politics. This is a grave mistake. It ignores higher obligations. It also represents a false hope that this empire can be rescued from impending moral ruin. Empires rot and collapse from within, and this is precisely how they do it. Why this urge to believe our own empire is so exceptional? Perhaps it's the optimism Americans are deservedly famous for, but this too is part of the problem. When times are such that mounting alarm and disillusionment are the only sane reactions, unflagging optimism becomes lunacy. As should be clear by now, I have little patience for the quasi-left palaver that, quote, the American people aren't the problem, close quote. This may seem true to certain progressives looking no further than their own social circles, but held up against the entire society, this smug motto resolves as a thin populist lie. As such, it only deepens the web of U.S. political conceit and depravity. Truth and only truth will set us free, and the truth is that most Americans either 1. Experience patriotic themes as a kind of religion and follow along with blind faith, or 2. Fully understand the meaning of conquest and are complicit in its interests, or 3. Most common, don't want to think about it at all. It's difficult to say which of these is most dangerous. If these were not the basic truths of their tendencies, they would have forced this government onto a whole different track starting 230 years ago. I am sick to death of hearing excuses for this. The American left has always been weak and is now more crushed down, dilapidated, and weak-minded than ever. One of its main problems is it's been poisoned with so many of these crypto-right poses, a la the people aren't the problem. The aggregate personality of the American people is precisely the problem, just as it was for the good Germans, and the rest of the world isn't so self-deluded about this. By mouthing this nice-sounding moronic slogan, U.S. leftists only reveal the depth of their confusion, thus informing their international counterparts that they just don't get it and can't be trusted. Make no mistake, I love my country. I desperately love this land and all the life that lives on it. These are the most sacred things in my world. I love some of its people, the ones I deem worthy of this highest esteem. Loving these things does not distract me, however, from the damnable flaws of this society as a whole or of a government that embodies the worst in it, and in my view, rolling all that up, the sacred along with the abominable, into a single object of worship as the purest form of political idiocy, a fraudulent ethic imposed by obvious charlatans. This rejection of patriotism as theology is a fundamental requisite of political sanity. In this, as in so many ways, America's alleged left desperately needs to slap itself awake and regain some semblance of hard intellect. Irreducibly, the left is a phenomenon of intelligent people who've known real disadvantage and injustice. Since World War II, as our general wealth and privilege have grown surreal, this axiomatic identity has disintegrated and the true leftist perspective along with it taken over by a leftist light whose insights are shallower, weaker, more self-absorbed. This has given much traction to third-way con artists like Lyndon LaRouche and Alex Jones, whose trademark sophism is left and right are meaningless. True enough, I suppose. When critical awareness of class is subverted by one's own unexamined classist aspirations, as is true of Americans generally, it is this visceral personal reaction to class realities, polarized from outraged criticism to quiet complicity, that truly delineates the right from the left, and the difference between these poles is enormously real as the gulf between truth and lies, between heroism and cowardice, between integrity and corruption, between triumphant rationality and facultative stupidity. In our own lifetimes, this beautifully simple right-left dividing line has been obscured and mystified by a vast army of scholars. This is not the Enlightenment anymore, Dorothy. Peering into a crystal ball and looking upon America today, U.S. leftists of the 1930s on back would not be shocked by the suggestion that our present condition is more like that of Nazi Germany than different. They would only be dismayed at seeing it for themselves. Relative to the political scene of 1880 to 1930, the American left is disturbingly centrist and wimpy, while the far right is off the chart. Fascism, that is, the self-centered conservative mentality taken to totalitarian extremes, just feels right to a great many of these people, obsessed as they are with personal advantage. They would have liked Nazi Germany, too, but since it's been fixed in their minds as the ultimate villain, they'll never admit this to themselves. The 1960s did not arrest America's descent into depravity, only sent it off on a strange digression. There were some true believers who became remarkably influential, but many of their followers in the youth counterculture were exceedingly shallow, as they proved during the 80s and 90s. The radical youth of the 1960s was merely the first great post-war wave of what is now a permanent feature of American society. Coddled children who've known only surreal abundance and security, and who take up radical ideals as rebellious narcissists' plaything, then just as narcissistically settle into stodgy conservatism as they discover middle-class comforts. With characteristic conceit, they call this transition growing up, when in fact they never once set foot beyond the infantile psychology of privilege. Those 1960s idealists are now the captains of American commerce and politics, the present staggering corruption of which is their own handiwork. It's an age-old tale of privilege's effect on integrity and maturation. Not only is this an effect of surreal median wealth, but also a deliberate engineered product of the public relations industry's grandest agenda. This sort of thing is precisely why it exists. Now pulling in several hundred billion dollars per year, the U.S. PR industry has eclipsed journalism as the root source of public information, and yet its theories, methods, operations, and objectives are among the best-kept secrets in the world today. As agents of state skullduggery, the private sector offers many advantages over government agencies, and disinformation is a perfect example. PR firms, first of all, specialize in mass manipulation and do it better. Two, they're less vulnerable to public oversight and can be even more secretive. And three, should their activities be uncovered, they provide an unequaled buffer of plausible deniability. They have consequently become the big domestic players in the various psychological operations usually associated with the CIA, Soviet information bureaus, etc. To wit, blanket dissemination of propaganda, lurking subversions of constitutional freedoms, including freedom of the press, the maintenance of all manner of omissions, including state secrets, suppression of unapproved ideas, philosophies, or subcultures, the charade known as rule of law. Furthermore, the PR industry's main clients are major corporations, ergo the aristocracy, whose disinformation agenda intersects with the government's darkest tendencies. Modern public relations is certainly the largest piece of modern America's astonishing and terrifying perceptual engineering achievements. All this may seem to run far afield from Iraq and the Downing Street fracas, but I don't think it really does. Downing Street is a window carelessly opened onto the rancid guts of the true political order. It only intimates a larger context that must be kept in full sight at all times, lest we fall into the inane habit of arranging deck chairs. If my judgment of Americans is too severe, I will know this when they prove it to me.